Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Always a pleasure to be able to share this information with you. And though a lot of you are probably on holiday today, I hope that you enjoy your day. And it's always, to me, important that we have a broader spectrum of insights into every condition with multiple voices, even some that are contradictory, so that we can then decide which of these ideas about how we should live our life and what is good for us or not good for us. We can't just listen to one source. And even if I'm that one source for many people, challenge it. Seek other sources and then ask yourself, what is reasonable? What makes common sense? Have you tried something and found that it works for you? Have you tried something and it doesn't work for you? And then you make your choice. And that freedom of choice is crucial. I fully support freedom of choice. I fully support that it's your body. You have a right to do with it what you want. However, what if what you think you're going to do with your body is based upon being propagandized and that you've been given all this information? But what if the only information you know about your diet comes from television and comes from advertisements on television? Well, let's go back. Let's go back to 1972 when two mothers up in Boston were outraged by the kind of commercials they saw on Saturday morning television, which was promoting junk food, sugar-coated cereals. And that's what their kids saw. And the commercials, very clever, had little leprechauns or things. And in one commercial in particular, the leprechauns turned over a cart of vegetables and then promoted the sugar-coated little cereal. And that's what kids go into a supermarket and demand they have. If not, they'll throw a little temper tantrum frequently. And so they said we should have control over the type of information that's presented to our children, because the adults are not there watching the children's television with them. The children do that. And the parents don't realize how much propaganda goes into that child's mind. Well, we're all susceptible to propaganda. I mean, just think of right now how many television radio programs, based upon their political and ideological views, are promoting, you know, promoting conflict, promoting that we have to be tough and we have to, you know, we have to show might, and so therefore money goes to the military-industrial complex without even thinking. Both left and right, conservative and liberal, are giving untold amounts of money to this industry. Is that where it should go? Well, if we don't have a lot of money and we're giving it all to a couple different industries, the medical industry, the banking industry, and then when they make mistakes, we bail them out. When they tell us a contract should cost one amount and it costs five times more, nobody cares. But what happens if you're unemployed? And shouldn't we help that person? Well, we should, but we're not. What about de-ghettoizing? We're not doing that. I give this as an example because our positions, our feelings about our lives and other people are no small measure determined by who's telling us what we should think, what we should believe, and that's propaganda. And that's why I want you to not make any decisions based upon propaganda or hidden biases that you wouldn't know about. So therefore, you know, just take your time, do your homework, and then whatever choice you make, at least you're making it from a more informed position. For example, today, from Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich, Germany, they're talking about colon cancer. Well, colon cancer is completely preventable, and it's not genetic. It's our diet. It's a diet that congests material in your colon. For example, you don't have to be told that what you eat will directly impact the frequency of your defecations. And the rule in health is, as you eat a meal, you should also pass the remnants of a previous meal. Well, that's a good, healthy colon, and that's one that's less likely to have inflammation. But when you're drinking coffee, and coffee is highly inflammatory, and that's interfering with the hydrochloric acid causing hyperacidic condition in the stomach, then you burp it back up into the esophagus. Now you have a higher incidence of inflammation in your esophagus, which can lead to esophageal cancer. But more importantly, it can disrupt normal digestion. Caffeine is a diuretic. And therefore, when you're having coffee, and I know people that actually take vitamins in the morning, whatever they take, with coffee. Okay, well, you have far less likelihood of those vitamins being digested and absorbed and utilized than if you just took it with a glass of water or a glass of juice. But again, if enough people drink coffee in the morning and they get them up, then they're not asking, why don't I have normal energy in the morning? Why can't I just bounce out of bed? Well, because take a look at, are you sleeping properly? If you didn't get a good night's sleep, you're not going to have the natural energy in the morning. So you get an artificial boost of energy. Well, what about mid-morning? You want a coffee break. Okay, what's a coffee break? To pick you up. An afternoon coffee break to pick you up. So why do you need picked up? Because the body's more than capable of supplying you energy all day long. Lots of glycogen stored in your muscle tissues and glucose in your bloodstream. No, because you've gotten so used to getting that immediate roller coaster. I'm up now, I got sugar, and or I got caffeine, or I got a donut with a cola, so I got a double amount of caffeine. That exhausts your adrenal glands. Just like laxatives that were very common back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and advertising all over the place. Why do you need a laxative? Because you were eating the wrong food, not enough fiber, not enough water, and as a result, too much meat, and that caused everything in the intestine to kind of go into a traffic jam. Like you, normal, it's 70 miles an hour on a highway, and in the intestine, that food just goes smoothly through. You start eating a diet that's high in fat, and fat slows everything down. It's like suddenly, fat's on the road, 5 miles an hour. Well, the longer food is in contact with the very sensitive mucous membrane lining of your intestine and colon, well, the more inflammation occurs because it's highly acidic foods and bad bacteria from the sugars. So now you got sugars that are bad, meat that is bad, processed foods that are bad, refined carbohydrates that are bad, and trans fats that are bad, and all that makes you more susceptible to colon irritation, inflammation, and then cancer. So when you go on a plant-based diet, have lots of healthy fiber, lots of chlorophyll, lots of the cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, kale, mustard greens, mustard, radishes, that has indole-3 carbonyl. It has sulfur, garlic, and onions the same way. Great for you, great for your intestines. Cleans out that intestine, kills a lot of bad bacteria, and that's healthy. But we're not used to eating those foods. We're used to eating just a very limited diet made in different ways. But, you know, you can make meat in 100 different ways, but it's still just meat. And then that congests the intestine. I give you that as a little background because you have to have a certain mindset in order to open up that intestine. And when was the last time you saw an ad on television? Maybe for an orange juice. But even that I wouldn't suggest because that's bottled orange juice. That means it was pasteurized. That means you're not going to have the same amount of vitamin C. Just a fresh glass of orange juice where you put 4 oranges or 5 oranges in to make yourself a 16-ounce glass of juice, throw in some grapefruit, throw in some lemon into lemon juice, you've got yourself a spectacularly healthy juice to start your day. In fact, the new science refutes the old science that shows that citrus juices were understated in their ORAC, that's a term that establishes the amount of antioxidants in your blood, and those antioxidants trap the free radicals, neutralize them, so there's less damage to your cells. So you're literally giving your body a reprieve from being beaten up on by free radicals every time you have a fresh glass of citrus juice. Okay, and now your body's going to be cleaned out, and that's what's good. But we're not doing that, and we should. Now, here's the latest study. Curcumin activates tumor suppression signaling pathway. What does that mean? According to Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich, colorectal cancer is one of the most common types of cancer. In more than half of all cases, an important protective mechanism in cells is inactivated by mutations. The tumor suppressor gene P53. The product of this gene, a transcription factor, induces a microRNA molecule called MIR34, which plays a critical role in tumor suppression. a team led by a professor of experimental and molecular pathology at the university has now demonstrated in cell cultures and in a mouse model that curcumin, yeah, the spice that comes from turmeric, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N, can bridge this silenced protective mechanism by activating an alternative, a specific signaling pathway that induces the expression of MIR34. So, by every time you have curcumin, you're helping protect yourself from cancer. All right? And by the way, there are tens of thousands of articles in the peer-reviewed literature on curcumin. It does so many good things. 500 to 1,000 milligrams every day in your diet would be terrific. But this is way, you know, if you had more fiber from berries and fruits, that would be terrific. If you had more water in the diet so you're properly hydrated, that would be terrific. If you didn't eat sugars with your meals that cause fermentation and gas and bloating, that would be terrific. And if you got rid of the proteins from animals and the saturated fats, that would be absolutely terrific. And we could help reduce our incidence of colorectal cancer and the itis, ileitis, colitis, vesicolon, by a substantial margin. It took a little longer there because I just wanted to understand that even though the science is very technical, the application is very simple. For example, University of Massachusetts, according to them, in a nutritional comparison of plant-based dairy products and yogurt, almond milk yogurt came out on top, according to the lead researcher at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Quote, plant-based yogurts overall have less total sugar, less sodium, and more fiber than dairy, but they have less protein, calcium, and potassium than dairy. Okay, well, how about this? If you want a yogurt because you want the bacteria, the good bacteria, the probiotics, why not simply look and see how much probiotics they're giving you? Oh, they don't. I went into a store recently and I looked at 9 different types of yogurt, plant-based. Not one had the amount. Could that be because, well, there's not much in there? Could be. I don't know their motive for not putting it on the label. So if I want a really healthy gut, and if I want to reduce my risk of diseases of the colon, and if I want to build up my immune system, then I'm going to know how much of a bacteria I want in my body, a probiotic. And therefore, if it says 2 billion, 5 billion, that's good. That's good. Even if it's, let's say, 200 or 300 million, that's good. But when they don't give it, that's not good. Now, if you want a yogurt simply because you like yogurt, you've had dairy yogurt, and now you want to go to a healthier yogurt, what's a healthier yogurt? Why? Because a lot of people are allergic to casein and whey, the two real strong components in dairy. They'll have mucus. They'll be hawking up a lot. They'll wake up in the morning with a little puffiness under the eyes. They'll have a little mucus at the edge of the eye and maybe in the nose. So they clear their throat, and they blow their nose, and they wipe off their eyes, and okay, and they go jogging, and now the puffiness comes down. Well, you're actually having an allergic reaction. Why not have something made from plants? Coconuts, cashew yogurt, almond yogurt. Now, I don't support almond yogurt, and I don't support almond milk because of the amount of water that an almond tree requires, and then also the amount of bees that die in transport to and from the California almond fields, and having bees my entire adult life. I currently have hives, and I've had as many as 132 hives. And I see what happens when bees are kept in a beautiful environment without pesticides, without the neonicotinoid sprays, and they live long lives. Far longer, and there's no bee collapse, no colony collapse. And yet we know for a fact, it's not a supposition, that the neonicotinoids kill bees by the hundreds of billions. In fact, in some years, nearly half of the beehives in America are destroyed. And yet we continue to use these hives that are sprayed with the chemicals, neonicotinoids. Now, you can ask why. Why would we do that? That's just stupid. Well, because we do a lot of stupid things. But behind it all is someone who's got power and money and doesn't want to change. So I don't drink almond milk. Now, coconut milk, cashew milk, those are good. Rice milk, those are good. And they're going to be healthier. Because if you're making a product that is supposed to replace something like dairy, you're going to want to know, okay, dairy's going to have more calcium and magnesium, then fortify it with calcium and magnesium, the same amount you would get or even more if you drank dairy. And the smarter people in the field are doing that now. You'll see sugar-free milks. Now, they're bland, but that's good. You can spark them up, put some cinnamon in them, allspice in them, whatever you want to do. But you're getting a healthier product. That's what counts. Just want to share that with you. So, you know, get your plant-based dairy and yogurts. But when it doesn't give you the amount of probiotics, then probably doesn't have a lot to give. Now, from the State University of Campinas in Brazil comes a study about resistance training, focusing on the load or number of repetitions leads to the same muscle growth. So which kind of resistance training promotes more muscle growth? Low load with many repetitions or high load with fewer repetitions? Well, according to a study conducted at the State University in Sao Paulo in Brazil, they're the same. The study lasted 8 weeks and involved 18 volunteers in two different training protocols. One group had the high load, lots of weight exercise, but fewer repetitions, while the other one had low load, less weight, and far more repetitions. Muscle mass was measured in the first and last exercise sessions. A comparison showed they were virtually the same. Now, for those of us who do crossover training, you should do both. You should do heavier weight and less reps. Let's say I'm doing a curl with a dumbbell. And I put on 20 pounds, and I can do 20, 30, 40. Okay, and then I use 15 pounds, and I can do 60. All right, they're both going to give you the same outcome. So if you don't have enough muscles, use less weight and more repetitions. If you have stronger muscles, go for higher weight and fewer repetitions. They both give you the benefit. All right, so that's important. Again, a lot of people in this audience work out. I want them to know that. Now, from Louisiana State University, an article in the Journal of Infectious Disease, a study finds that diet contributes to risk of human papillomavirus-related cancers. This is something new. This was done at the Louisiana State University Health New Orleans School of Public Health and Medicine, and they find that your diet can directly contribute to human papillomavirus infection leading to cervical cancer. All right. Quote, this study showed that women who did not eat fruits, dark green vegetables, and beans had a significantly higher risk of genital high-risk human papillomavirus infection. In addition, intake of whole grains and dairy was inversely associated with low risk, meaning the more dairy, the more at risk, the less dairy, the less at risk. The more of these grains, the higher the risk, the less of these grains, the lower the risk. So, a healthy diet has a protective effect with human papillomavirus. And this was not a small study, 10,543 women. And this was followed for 13 years through the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. The women were 18 to 59 with valid genital HPV infection data. And so, a healthy diet, once again, lowers the risk substantially and by almost 59.3%. Good information. And let's hear it for the mighty broccoli, sprouts. Everyone listening right now, in the smallest apartment or the biggest house, you can sprout broccoli. It's easy to do, only takes about 10 days. You can sprout a big bowl of it. You just, you know, soak your seeds and then rinse in the morning, and then you put a cloth over the top and the bowl, and you You drain it. You rinse it in the morning and the evening. You drain it so it doesn't get soggy, doesn't cause any kind of excessive mold creating. And in a week or two, about 2 weeks, you've got these wonderful broccoli sprouts. Why? Why should you eat a broccoli sprout? Well, listen to Johns Hopkins University and several other institutions. We're testing the power of broccoli sprouts to protect people from air pollutants. We already know from multiple studies that the broccoli sprouts protect you from cancer. Or if you have cancer, you should be eating broccoli sprouts every day, a whole bowl. But they conducted a 12-week randomized placebo-controlled study, and they found that the area that they were testing people was very high in pollution. And in fact, in China itself is the world's largest emitter of air pollution. So they took the most polluted area of China to do this. And half the participants were asked to consume a half a cup of broccoli sprouts, sprout drink every day. And the control group drank pineapple and lime juice. The results were published in the Journal of Cancer Prevention Research. They found that throughout the 12-week period, the participants drinking the broccoli sprout drink increased their rate of exertion of benzene by 61%. Wow. So you're excreting benzene at 61%? You say, well, Gary, what the heck is benzene? Benzene is a very powerful known carcinogen. In the United States, benzene exposure comes predominantly from car and truck exhaust, and emissions from coal and oil combustion and evaporation from industrial sites and gas stations. And smoking is another source of benzene exposure. In addition, the study participants taking the broccoli sprout drink increased their excretion of what is called acrolein by 23%. And smoking and secondhand smoke is also a source of acrolein. Now, burning fuel like gasoline and oil is another source. And acrolein is toxic to humans, and when you inhale it, you can end up having upper respiratory tract irritation and congestion. So how about that? Something as simple as broccoli sprouts. Now, they had a broccoli sprout drink. And why? Because it's rich in sulforaphane. There's more sulforaphane in the sprouts, 100 times more sulforaphane in broccoli sprouts than in broccoli. So every day, have a bowl, not a cup. Now, what I don't know from this study is how much broccoli sprouts they had to juice to get a half a cup. And because sprouts don't give you very much juice at all. I mean, you could juice a bushel basket of sprouts and get, you know, a couple ounces of juice, unlike watermelon or celery that's got a lot of juice. So what I suggest you do is this. Don't think about juicing it. Think about eating it. Now, dice up some raw red onions, run it under water for about a half a minute, and that way it's not going to burn, and you dice that in, and then throw some other nutrients in. All right? You do that, then you got something really going for you. And also, finally, today, Florida Atlantic University found that running throughout middle age keeps older adults' neurons wired. So you protect your neurons, you protect your brain, you protect cognition, memory, and awareness if you just keep running. And aging often is accompanied by cognitive decline. And among the first structures of the brain affected are the hippocampal area and adjacent cortices. These are areas essential for learning and memory. And deficits in cognitive ability are associated with reduced hippocampal volume. Your brain shrinks. And degradation of synaptic connectivity between hippocampal and periendotorhinal cortex. Just imagine in an overly simplistic manner, but an overhead power line. You have your main grid that then feeds electricity to all these subgroups, and then if something happens and you snap one of those wires, you lose electricity on that particular connectivity. Every time you have a drink of alcohol, you're snapping all these dendritic connections in the brain. You snap enough of them, you lose your memory. Now, the good news is alpha-lipoic acid helps rebuild these, but we're not using alpha-lipoic acid, and we're continuing to drink, and that's not good, all right? Just sharing all this with you at this time, and a little longer than normal. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Again, hopefully tomorrow I'll be back on my microphone, but today I'm broadcasting on a telephone. That's why the sound is not what it normally would be. But I'm pretty sure you're able to hear the information. Now, on a recent program, we played a short clip, about 5 minutes, of a highly respected, very experienced, 20 years, Canadian broadcaster, the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company. And he was orthodox. He broadcast for all these major outlets and investigative journalists. But then something happened with COVID that changed his perception. He started seeing that the news outlets were not creating the stories. They're being fed the stories. They're being fed who you should trust and who you should not, who you should allow to be quoted and who not. Well, that's censorship. That bothered him. And he hadn't seen that before. We've been seeing that for a long time in the United States, and it's existed in Canada also. The powers behind the scenes, because historically, someone who doesn't like a story, let's say you're a major manufacturing company or a Fortune 500 company, and you see that someone's about to do an expose on you. You're not just going to sit there and say, okay, it'll pass. No, you're going to make some calls to public relations departments, to your legal department. Can we stop this? No, they have a right to publish. So then you call someone that you know at Facebook or Google or one of the important sources that we go to, like Twitter. And you say, look, this is disinformation. Don't play it. Right? You don't want to promote disinformation, do you? No, we don't. And that's exactly what happened with Twitter. In fact, it got so bad, so pernicious, that the FBI had people working Twitter in their office. So that's why we got to pay attention. All right? So this guy woke up. Now, we wouldn't have known this if you even suggested this was happening. Oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist. No. This is reality. This happened. We have proof of it. And yet nobody apologizes, and the media continues to defend and protect those people who were used as willing pawns for disseminating propaganda and banning anyone who was telling the truth. So censorship is rampant today everywhere in the world. And there are only certain forms that you can trust the information. That it, objective or not, at least it's not biased. Here's him telling the story. And I think it's important you hear him, because he was nowhere on anyone's radar. Nowhere. And now he is. And now he'll be attacked because he was one of the top people in the country. So when you have one of your most respected journalists, orthodox as can be, and ethical, and now he's saying, wow, I didn't know until I looked how bad it was. And then he gives examples, and you'll hear these examples. Now, I don't know how long we're going to play this, but I think it's important enough to spend some time realizing this is going on. Okay? Now to the clip.
Warns that the lab's work on bat coronaviruses and their potential human transmission represented a risk of a new SARS-like pandemic. So not only at the moment when Adrian Arsenault was telling you don't believe your father if he thinks it came from a lab, it was not only probable that COVID came from the lab, but it had been predicted that it would happen 2 years prior by the U.S. government. So how does Adrian Arsenault say it wasn't, and don't believe anyone, including your family? Flash forward a year, Vanity Fair magazine, which is known for its excellent investigative reporting, published an extremely long and exhaustive piece where all they did was go online and look at publicly available scientific papers going back about a decade. The first one in 2013 was by Xizheng Li, who's the director of emerging infectious disease at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. She's known as the Bat Lady, and this is not a derogatory term. Actually, her scientist friends started calling her that because there was an outbreak of a SARS-like respiratory virus in a mine, and the miners died very, very quickly. And she is documented to having gone to that mine, scraped the bat guano off the mine and brought it to Wuhan to examine. In 2014, she began publishing about the coronavirus from Chinese bats. In 2015, there was another paper that Vanity Fair found where Xizheng Li discussed successfully inserting a protein from this Chinese horseshoe bat virus into the SARS virus of 2002. Creating a brand new infectious pathogen. 2015, this scientific paper was published. Vanity Fair found it online. CBC could have found it, but they were too busy telling you don't trust anyone who believes this. In 2019, there was a paper actually published by one of the lab directors at Wuhan outlining the safety deficiencies in the Wuhan lab where he worked. And in 2019, right around the time that the U.S. government, the U.S. embassy in Beijing was warning Washington about a potential SARS-like pandemic leaking out of this unhygienic lab, a number of the Wuhan lab scientists published a paper together describing genetically engineered rats that they had grown with humanized lungs and developed them in the Wuhan lab. So this is a pretty hot smoking gun coming out of the Wuhan lab. There are three labs in the world working on coronavirus, according to the Vanity Fair investigation. Two of them are in the United States, one of them's in Wuhan. If this thing started at a wet market outside the Wuhan lab, it was because one of the staff members of the Wuhan lab walked into the wet market and brought it there. That is the most likely scenario. Now flash forward to this month, March 2023, U.S. FBI Chief Christopher Wray says the China lab leak was most likely. The quote is, the FBI has for quite some time now assessed that the origins of the pandemic are most likely a potential lab incident. So the CBC had no evidence that it wasn't. They wanted you to believe that it wasn't. There's a definition of news gathering, and you'll see, interestingly, that news gathering is one word in the English language. It's not two words as it appears that it should be. And that's because it's very specific. It's the process of doing research on news items, especially ones that will be broadcast on television or printed in a newspaper. Now, how much research was done by the CBC to determine 10 days after the emergency that it didn't happen in a lab? Another definition here is propaganda. Persuasive mass communication that filters and frames the issues of the day in a way that strongly favors particular interests, usually those of a government or a corporation. Also, the intentional manipulation of public opinion through lies and half-truths and the selective retelling of history. This is what was going on in that piece. That's why it felt so wrong to me, because there was no news involved. There was only propaganda. What the Washington Post did with its lab leak theory story 10 days after the CBC said it wasn't from the lab was news gathering. It was investigative reporting. What the CBC did when it said don't trust your family if they think it came from a lab, that's propaganda. That's the difference in the definition of those two things. The Vanity Fair piece, reviewing scientific publications for a decade and uncovering the fact that human lungs were engineered on rats in Wuhan lab in 2019, just before the outbreak, is news gathering. Exceptional news gathering. I'm jealous of how good that news gathering was. What the BBC did, reporting on the FBI, saying they've known for a long time that it came from the lab, was news gathering. That's kind of news of the day, daily news. They said it, we're telling you they said it. What the CBC did by warning Canadians not to trust their fathers about a lab leak theory was propaganda. March 4th, 2021, about a year after the emergency, the editor-in-chief of CBC News, Brody Fenlon, wrote on his blog A recent survey found that about half of Canadians think journalists are purposely trying to mislead them. Well, that's because we're on to you. At least half of us pay attention to our gut, and we know that you are purposely trying to mislead us. But Mr. Fenland said that CBC is going to correct this. To promote trust in journalism, the CBC has joined four organizations. I didn't know that they joined these organizations until I began to look into this a little bit. One of them is called the Trusted News Initiative, which is designed to filter news through its own trust filter system. Another one's called the Journalism Trust Initiative. It's basically the same name, but this one does more or less the same thing. Another one's called the Trust Project, and then Project Origin. And notice that none of these organizations have the word truth in them. If you tell the truth consistently, trust is automatic. If you don't tell the truth consistently, you have to say things like, please trust me. So I'm just going to quickly outline what these things are, because they're all basically the same thing. The Trusted News Initiative and the CBC announced together on the 27th, prior to the Adrian Arsenault piece, that CBC and Radio Canada are joining an industry collaboration of major media and technology organizations to rapidly identify and stop the spread of harmful coronavirus disinformation. I think the pandemic really started in China about 4 months prior to this, and 4 months prior to an unknown virus killing so many people, there is no disinformation. The scientists among our commissioners will tell you there is only information, and all information is critical at the beginning, particularly at the beginning. So immediately they're in a position of pushing one side of the story. Stopping misinformation means censoring. Censorship, pure and simple. The Journalism Trust Initiative, a second organization that they joined, is run by an outfit called Reporters Sans Frontières, Reporters Without Borders. And when I was working as a correspondent in the Middle East, the Reporters Without Borders would take the side of, say, a Syrian journalist who was writing something against the dictator Hafez al-Assad and maybe had been imprisoned, and they were trying to bring attention of the world to this imprisoned journalist. That's the kind of excellent work this group did. In 2020, it shifted completely to start something called the Journalism Trust Initiative, starting an algorithmic indexing based on their criteria to improve your revenues, meaning if you run your news organization through their filter, they'll make sure that it gets up to the top of the Google page, so you'll get more clicks and more money will improve your revenue. There was an incentive there. Project Origin is another one that is it's a collaboration between the CBC, the BBC, the New York Times, and Microsoft. And one of these organizations is not a news organization, it's a tech organization. One of the things they talk about here is that the technical provenance approach, in conjunction with media education and synthetic media detection techniques, to help establish a foundation of trust. Not truth, trust is what they're looking for. One of their tools is called the power of the machine, harnessing AI to fight disinformation. So I can only surmise from this that Microsoft is using AI to identify anybody speaking words that they want to identify as to be censored or called misinformation, label misinformation so you will agree with their censorship. The next one is called the Trust Project. Now, this one is largely tech. Craigslist, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft are involved. Again, helping tech support trustworthy news. Helping tech. What do we care about tech and truth and news? How are they together all of a sudden? We stand for integrity. They say, look for our 8 trust indicators. We built the trust indicators. So they have listed, all they have to do is tell the truth. They don't need no 8 trust indicators. And interestingly, Google, Facebook, and Bing all use the trust indicators in display and behind the scenes. So somehow they are censoring it before it gets to you. These are the members of the Trust Project. Now, this goes way beyond the CBC. Globe and Mail is also in there. CTV is a member. The Walrus magazine in Canada is supposed to be an independent thought magazine. They're part of this project. The Canadian Press. So I put this up there to let you know that it is not just the CBC. The reason they all sound the same is because they're all part of this trust campaign. But the CBC is also part of something else. It's something with just public broadcasters. It's called the Global Task Force for Public Media. Global Task Force exists to defend the values and interests of public media. Excellent. But it was formed to develop a consensus and a single strong voice among them. And that's the CBC, BBC News, ABC Australia, Korean Broadcasting, they joined recently, France Television, Radio New Zealand, ZDF from Germany, and SVT from Sweden. Now, I can't imagine, having worked at the CBC for almost a decade and being told every day our job is to elevate the voices of Canadians on Canadian stories, to unite our vast country and make us all feel as one. What single issue do we have with Korean Broadcasting, when that is our mandate? What issue does Radio New Zealand have with Swedish television when their mandate is the same, to elevate their own people? This is a bizarre conglomerate of public broadcasters, and I would put forth to the panel that the public broadcasters are the ones that are not easily bought because the advertisers don't exist and therefore they have no influence. So something else was done here. Now, the public task force is headed by our CBC president, Catherine Tait. She is the current president. 3 months ago, she gave a speech at Simon Fraser University. The first word out of her mouth was trust. Trust seems to be in short supply. The next phrase is disinformation, conspiracy theories, YouTube rabbit hole. This is the Trusted News Initiative mantra. This is what she was talking about at Simon Fraser University. She goes around, makes speeches, and says, please trust us. So let's get to what they do, in addition to the first piece that I saw in the National that rubbed me the wrong way. I listened to a piece one day in my car by Matt Galloway, again, a national treasure. I love this guy. When I first heard him on CBC Toronto, I thought, oh my God, there's a future. He might be the next Zosky. And then he turned on us. He did a story on March 29th, 2021, where he interviewed a guy from something called the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And I thought this was going to be about anti-Semitism or something, digital hate. Instead, the guy said, people who are recommending vitamin C intravenous and hydrogen peroxide nebulization are hate. And I thought, well, how is recommending health treatments? I mean, vitamin C intravenous has been going on for 50 years. It's used in cancer treatment. It's used in all kinds of treatment. Hydrogen peroxide nebulization is a simple drugstore hydrogen peroxide 3% mixed with water and vaporized into a mask so you clean out your nasal passage and stop viral replication, and it's common. You can buy them. So how are these things dangerous? How are they hateful? It was particularly interesting to me. But the expert guest went on to say that these people will kill, and he said that the hydrogen peroxide nebulizers, which are benign, are literally inhaling bleach. This is his words, literally inhaling bleach. It's actually not. It's actually literally a hydrogen peroxide nebulizer. It's literally nebulizing hydrogen peroxide. It's not literally inhaling bleach. Inhaling bleach is literally inhaling bleach. He lied. So why is he lying to Matt Galloway? Why is Matt Galloway letting him lie to me on the radio? And I know it's a lie for a fact. The same guy from the Center for Countering Digital Hate, who also went on to say anti-vaccine misinformation is hate, which I believe diminishes the power of that word for all those who have experienced it. He went on Marketplace to say this, but then Marketplace took it to the next level. They became a censor. Marketplace reported 800 pieces of information to social media giants, attempting to have them censored, claiming they were misinformation. And then they complained that the media giants only took down 12% of what CBC said was wrong on the internet. So my questions are, since when is the CBC deciding what misinformation on other media platforms is? What is it their business? They're the CBC. Do your job. Pay attention to yourself. Why are you going out correcting, in your view, what's wrong with other media? How is the CBC or Marketplace or this reporter qualified to comb the internet for 800 posts and declare them to be false? We never found out in the piece. And who at the CBC is the arbiter of truth and misinformation on the behalf of us Canadians who like to decide for ourselves?
And now let's hear from Neil Oliver. He's a historian. He's also very much in the form of a Will Rogers, if any of you know about Will Rogers, the philosophical cowboy back in the 19-teens and 20s. He wasn't college educated, but he had an abundance of common sense. Well, you know, Oliver's highly educated, and he talks in a way that we can understand. Now, whatever your position is on the environment, and we all want to protect our environment, and I've been an active environmentalist and activist my entire life. I've written award-winning books and documentaries on the subject. But a lot of the information that we're being told today about the environment is simply misinformation by people who want to steer huge amounts of money to private corporations in this private-public relationship to help the environment. Nothing that I see they're doing is right. They should be putting into geothermal, wave power, and a worldwide stop buying so much stuff that pollutes the environment, whether it's plastic, and stop all the plasticizing. We over-plasticize everything. I went to get a battery, and it was so... I couldn't open it. I had to get a pair of scissors, and even that was difficult to get a stinking little battery out of a bag. Well, that's going to last forever in the environment. So we need to have a message. Do you need everything you're purchasing? No, you don't. Can we recycle things? Yes, you can. Can we take obsolescence out, buying cheap stuff that it's cheaper just to throw it away? That shirt that you ripped, throw it away, buy another one, rather than taking it to a place and having it sewn. When you build in obsolescence into everything you're doing, then, it's another year, another cell phone upgrade. They don't need to upgrade these things. They have the technology that can make something that can last forever. But they don't. They want you to repeat buying because they need repeat profits. And so we're buying an awful lot of stuff. Probably 80% of the stuff we buy is not good for us and certainly not good for the environment. So why don't we have a national campaign to ask, do we need it? Do we need it, what we're buying? And can we reuse it? And are we buying too much food, for example, that we waste? And the answer is yes to all those. Yeah, we're buying stuff we don't need, and that pollutes the environment and pollutes our health. So we just need a whole new consciousness before we have billions of dollars thrown into something where politicians and people are connected with how much money they're going to make off a new solar system. Yeah, we need bladeless wind power. That I would support. I do not support our current wind power. And also, I don't support electric cars. That's a fraud. Why? Because if anyone actually did, and I have, the science and measure how much energy is created, how much pollution created by mining the minerals necessary to make the electric battery. Okay, well, we didn't think about that. Okay, so now, will the car last long enough to equal the amount of pollution that it created? No, it won't. So you're telling me to buy an electric vehicle because it's politically correct and wokeism wants us to do that, and yet we're stripping the environment, we're exploiting the environment, we're exploiting human labor all over Africa, millions of people are being exploited, and we don't care about any of that as long as we can show people by virtue shaming, look at me in my new electric vehicle. It's one of the dumbest things we've ever done. And yes, I'm opposed to it, but from a scientific and humanitarian point of view, there are not enough of us real, authentic scientists in the environmental movement. We have all these pop idiots out there telling us, oh, I got this. Well, what do you got? Did you ever go out to look at how many of these big, gigantic, and non-biodegradable wind power stations are broken, dead, don't work, and what they're doing to kill millions of birds worldwide and cause air pollution? No, we didn't look at that part. Okay, I see. So you only look at the part that made someone a lot of money, industries that become powerful, and then it's automatic. Renew, instead of doing something brand new. And now some are. There are now wind power storage facilities that don't have blades, therefore don't kill birds. They're small. You can put one in your backyard, and it will create enough wind power to handle the electricity for your home. Why aren't we promoting that? Why don't we have that as part of the building code? You must use that. We have solar paint. Why aren't we using that and promoting that? Because those are not get rich. No one's going to become a billionaire from that. So here's Neil Oliver. I think you'll find what he says important.
When it comes to the future of our species, there's a fork in the road. Some would say too many are looking back at that fork over their shoulders as governments around the world frog march their populations and civilizations towards misery, hardship and destruction. I'm nowhere near as gloomy as that last sentence makes me sound, though. In fact, more than anything else, I'm simply incredulous at the pitch of the nonsense being applied by policymakers to have us submit to their ruinous plans. It's so obvious now, the dismantling of the good, the construction of the bad, as to be unmissable. I'll keep saying what I believe to be true, that there's nothing green about the green agenda, just plain old greed. The evidence is before our eyes, and more members of those put-upon populations are demanding answers to questions. Some may have passed that fork in the road, but there's still time to turn around. The hiding of the truth, the obscuring and withholding of facts, is being pushed as our new normal. Sad to say, even when the truth is revealed, and more truth is revealed every day, too many find it too hard to look at. It's like a house infested with rats, but with the inhabitants finding the rats too hard to deal with and preferring to ignore the evidence all around. They keep their eyes closed instead. I see no rats, and so that must mean there are no rats. The lying is all around us, all the time. Living with lying, accepting lying, is another part of what is offered up as the new normal. In the novel Watership Down, the refugee rabbits find temporary respite in a warren filled with the saddest bunnies in England. There's plenty of food, but no joy whatsoever. The refugees learn the truth soon enough, that the sad rabbits have chosen to live in the knowledge the farmer has set snares, as well as piles of food. They can eat the free food, but they must accept they will be harvested at will. Rather than confront the truth, leave for pastures new perhaps, even if that meant less convenience, they turn blind eyes to what is right in front of them. I see no snares, they tell themselves, and so that must mean there are no snares. The biggest stick being wielded now by those driving the march along the road to nowhere is the claim our species is to blame for climate change, what they relentlessly refer to as a climate crisis. Having been browbeaten for decades, swathes of more than one generation has accepted our civilizations and ways of life must be surrendered, dismantled in the name of saving the Earth. But then last year, an organization called CLINTEL, the Climate Intelligence Foundation, published a document called the World Climate Declaration. It was signed by over 1,000 scientists and others from a scientific background. A Nobel Physics laureate was among them. And the declaration attracted huge attention on social media with its bold assertion that there is no climate emergency. The declaration also stated that, quote, Earth's climate has varied as long as the planet has existed, with natural cold and warm phases. The Little Ice Age ended as recently as 1850. Therefore, it's no surprise we're experiencing a period of warming. Needless to say, the declaration's signatories were roundly vilified and dismissed by the mainstream as having the wrong sort of scientific qualifications and were therefore not worth heeding. Based on extensive personal experience of the cancelling ways of the mainstream, I would say it was ever thus. But here we are at that fork in the road. Last week on this show, I asked my guests whether there are too many human beings alive on the planet or too few. That's the extent of the polarisation of the population debate, with all of us expected to pick one side and despise the other. I said last week, and I'll say again, that one camp or the other must be utterly wrong. And as a species, we urgently need to know which would lead us down the road to ruin if we let them. If the population debate is dangerously split, then so too is that concerning climate, with one side insisting rising temperatures and sea levels promise our destruction, and the other saying nothing of the sort is true. Again, we need to know, and urgently, which camp has got it wrong. And it's no longer good enough just to watch dissenters being hounded out of polite society. That the mainstream media laps up the talk of a world on the point of spontaneously combusting, entirely because of activity by humans, makes it dangerously difficult to ask questions, far less seek truthful answers. I'd go so far as to say someone's lying about the climate, deliberately lying to the people and pushing a false narrative shaped to cause fear and assure mass compliance that serves the intentions of vested interests. Here in the UK, the Met Office has predicted the sea level could rise by nearly 4 feet by the end of the century, putting swathes of the country, including parts of London, underwater. Other experts warn of sea level rises of 10 feet if the Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica collapses. So far, so catastrophic. And yet massive investment in property in London and in low-lying cities around the world continues unabated. What on earth are we to make of what might, bearing in mind mainstream predictions of wholesale flooding, be regarded as a level of recklessness by investors bordering on the insane? Actuaries calculate risk for insurance companies involved in mortgages and loans for such property investment. And yet none is calling a halt, writing off London, for example, as a suicidally bad risk, or New York, or other sea-level cities and locations around the world. The money men are not urging any imminent move away from the coast and to higher ground inland. Last month, that same Clintel Foundation published a damning analysis of the latest report from the International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, the body to which most governments around the world look for climate policy advice. On the topic of predicted rises in sea level, the Clintel report says readings from tide gauges, kit for monitoring sea level, show, quote, remarkably linear behaviour for more than a century, unquote. Simply put, despite doom-laden predictions, the sea level has barely changed in the last 100 years. And while we, the general public, are being frightened out of our wits by disaster mongering, those with the deepest pockets of all seem, judging by their actions, to harbour no such worries. In 2017, climate crisis activist John Kerry spent $11.7 million on a sprawling estate on the beach, in Martha's Vineyard. In 2020, Bill and Melinda Gates spent $43 million on a massive house on the beach, in Del Mar, near San Diego. The Obama family have their own luxurious beachfront home. When climate alarmist Al Gore, he of An Inconvenient Truth, ran for US president in 2000, he was apparently worth just $1.7 million. After decades of travelling the world in private jets to frighten the wits out of the proles, he has amassed an estimated $330 million. He owns multiple properties, including an ocean view home in Montecito, California, that he purchased in 2010 for nearly $9 million. Maybe those people are so wealthy they can contemplate watching such homes taken by the waves in their lifetimes, knowing they can afford to throw away tens of millions of dollars without consequence, without shedding a tear. But such contempt for sums beyond the reach of billions would hardly look good. The dear old IPCC also claims, quote, global temperatures are more likely than not unprecedented in the last 125,000 years. According to the Clintel Foundation, this ignores the well-documented event called the Holocene Thermal Maximum around 9,800 to 5,700 years ago, when evidence shows temperatures were often higher than now in many parts of the world. The IPCC ignores those inconvenient millennia altogether, as though they had never happened. Furthermore, according to Clintel, the IPCC ignored crucial peer-reviewed literature showing that normalised disaster losses have decreased since 1990 and that human mortality due to extreme weather has decreased by more than 95% since 1920. They continue, the IPCC, by cherry-picking from the literature, drew the opposite conclusions, claiming increases in damage and mortality due to anthropogenic climate change, which is to say caused by us humans.
And that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.